I think we'll start. There are people still wandering in, but I'll introduce the session first and then hand over to Mitch. The session is going to be probably a fairly familiar format, which is got about half an hour of presentation. Then we'll do the question and answers. Just remember, we are recording it, so please do wait for microphones. And there's a nice microphone lady up the back who will be passing that around. Right, so the session is determining an optimal distribution strategy, presented by Mitch Wood. He wrote a paper with the presentation as well with Greg Schneider. Just to very quickly introduce Mitch before I hand over, Mitch is a qualified actuary and senior consultant with Quantium, and Greg, his co-author, is also a co-founder of Quantium. Prior to joining Quantium, Mitch was a senior manager with PwC, where he was involved in developing the business intelligence practice. Mitch works closely with many of Australia's leading brands and has led large projects in Salesforce optimisation, strategic pricing, customer analytics and media optimisation. So lots of optimisation in there. So I'll hand over to Mitch and we'll hear all about it. Thank you. Ooh.
Some perilous?
Yes, just be careful.
Yeah. Okay, well, welcome. I think a good place to start is, why am I here today talking to you about distribution strategy? I think that comes down to three things for me. Number one, distribution is very important for financial services. Number two, there's not really a lot of science being applied to distribution currently. And number three, I mean, I'm really excited about the actuarial techniques that we're applying with a few companies and the potential value being added by those techniques. So if we just think for a moment about analytics and strategy and the involvement of actuaries in strategy, in terms of strategy, we can consider it in break it down into, say, the drivers of strategy into four, I guess the four Ps is a good way to think about it. So the four Ps of marketing: product, price, promotion, and place. If we start with product, historically we would say that there's been a reasonable level of sophistication in terms of analysis, and probably a reasonable level of involvement from actuaries. The sorts of things that would be involved, anything around product design, in terms of the analytics, it can be from simple customer surveys all the way up to actually choice experiments and very sophisticated analysis. Compare that with price, and traditionally price has been an area where actuaries are heavily involved and the analytics has been very very sophisticated. Everything from, you know, basic cost-plus pricing, market-based pricing, competitor analysis, price optimization, demand, all sorts of levels of analysis. Promotion. By promotion here, we're talking about marketing, understanding the effectiveness of your media, understanding the effectiveness of your activity in that area. In terms of promotion, historically, actuaries haven't been involved, but the analysis has been fairly substantial anyway. Over the past few years, that's increased. Actuaries are starting to get involved. And now I would say that promotion, the amount of sophistication being applied in promotion outstrips pricing. Talking about all the direct marketing activity, you've got all the data mining modelling, retention modelling, cross-sell, upsell. You've got all of the areas around understanding which media channels are more effective, TV, radio, press, and so on, and full media optimisation. Poor old placement. By placement, we mean distribution. I think comes in a last position. Basically, there's not a lot of analysis being applied and actuaries really aren't involved. In terms of distribution, the definition we're using and the discussions that we're talking about today is really understanding which channel is the most effective, how many salespeople or branches or stores do I actually need in each channel, and where should I locate them. In terms of an agenda for the talk, basically it's three sections. So in the first section, just talking about current approaches, what are people doing in terms of assessing distribution strategy now? We'll come out with, well, I guess, what we see as a better way going forward, our distribution framework, and look at some examples, a case example, which steps through some of the key insights from that. And the final stage is talking about optimisation. How can you actually optimise your distribution strategy? Okay, so as the summary is that current approaches are pretty basic. One approach is basically rules of thumb. So I'm considering the question, how many additional sales staff do I need? Or which areas require additional sales staff? And the sorts of rules of thumb that would be used are things like metrics that are created around customer density, customer basically foot flow in branches or stores, customer size, so what's the balances and so on, size of the market, demographic profile of customers in the area, and metrics around, well, how many salespeople do I have per sale, all sorts of stuff like that. So there's a lot of rules of thumb, and essentially they seek to look for areas that are low in terms of salespeople, low in resources, and basically combine that together to say these areas require more sales staff. The problem comes from how do you actually combine all those metrics together? And there's no real sort of cause and effect to what you're actually using. The other approach we've seen companies use is determine a average value of each salesperson or the sales force. So in this case, it's the average value. Now, we'll talk about our approach later on, which is to value each salesperson individually. But in this case, it's saying a total product, here's the value of the total product. Let's allocate that or attribute that to all the sales staff, and that's what we say each sales staff contributes. There's a number of problems with it, and we'll mention that in a minute. So the issues, I guess, with these approaches are averaging. Each salesperson is not equal, and they're not in an area that's basically equal. They're in areas that have higher or less opportunity. The question of where to put them, so what locations to actually put the people in, cannot be answered in the same set of analysis as how many do I need. So they're actually independent questions. Staff churn might not be allowed for. It might be allowed for an average value, but it's at an approximate level or at a total level. And probably the key issue is that there's no allowance for diminishing marginal returns. So if we say each salesperson is generating X value for the product, we end up with a situation where as we add salespeople, we're going to have increasing value, increasing margin. And clearly that can't be the case. At some point you're going to hit saturation. You're actually going to not be able to grow any further. So what do we propose? Our example here is based on a company that we worked with to develop a model to basically estimate the value of each salesperson. Obviously, it's just an example for that industry, so it'd be different in each industry. The key to this model is that the value is being generated for each salesperson. Okay, so starting at the left, each salesperson is generating a certain number of new sales. We also need to allow for the fact that there's churn of salespeople over time. So we're assuming there's a salesperson in the position already and they're a certain type of salesperson in a location. They're generating sales at a certain level. If we combine that with the probability that they'll churn over time, we get our expected new sales in total. Then we've got our customer cash flow model. So we need to know what cash flows are being generated every time we sell a product. So we've got the cash flow and the churn rate. Combine that together and we've got the expected customer cash flows. Overall, that generates the salesperson's revenue. So in this case, we've looked at it by tenure. So over time, this is for one salesperson, they're taken on at year zero, this is how much revenue we expect them to generate. And you can see the shape there, it's a little bit small, but it gradually increases and then it basically drops off rapidly. And that's because of two competing effects, and we'll show those in our later slides. Combine that together with the expense side, and we can estimate our expected profit. And this is all by an individual salesperson. So we can now go to a set of cash flows for that salesperson, take an NPV of that, and we've got the value generated by a salesperson. Okay, so one question once we've got a framework like this is, which parts will we actually model? Which parts need a predictive model? And which parts can we just use assumptions for? The rest of the presentation really concentrates on one component, the top left. The expected new sales for every salesperson. So we'll drill into that in a bit more detail. So what do we mean by sales force effectiveness? In this case, we're talking about the growth in sales. The growth in sales generated by the sales force. To model this accurately, we need to allow for all the possible influences on sales. Okay, so just starting at the top, we've got our other three P's, so price, product. We need to allow for data around, has the product changed over time? Has the price changed? We also need to allow for all the promotion activity. So what media has been spent in what volumes and in what channels and so on. Other channels, call centre, branches, stores, so on. We need to allow for the market, seasonality. I mean, that's a bit of a gimme. We need to allow for the economy and so on. Competitors' prices, competitor media, so if they're out there in the market, that's going to affect our sales, and market share, most importantly, so I'll show some stuff on market share later. the area, the population, the actual demographics of the area, how many actual people live there, because that's going to affect, well, at some point you're going to sell everything. You're going to be at capacity. So we need to know the area. And finally, the salesperson. I mean, that's the key for this analysis, understanding what the salesperson actually delivers to that process. So drilling into that a bit further, there's a range of factors that influence on the success of a new salesperson. For instance, the individual salesperson characteristics, things like their age, their gender, their personality type, past performance, the salesperson tenure. So obviously, the longer they've been in the position, the more likely they are to sell it at a higher rate. And does that continue to increase forever? I'll show some information on that later. The number of existing sales staff in the area. So this is a concept around, are you saturating that area? Have you actually got too many sales staff in there? There's internal competition. And the existing market share, how does that actually affect sales? So looking at the individual salesperson characteristics, most companies are doing psychometric testing these days, and it's proving to be reasonably valuable. But one of the challenges with psychometric testing is, how do you actually interpret all that data? There's a lot of questions. They're conflicting. Basically, some of them look like they're conflicting. Some of them are the same, telling you the same information. How do you work out which questions are the most important and how to actually use that in recruitment? One of the approaches we've applied is a statistical approach called principal components analysis, which essentially pulls out. So we've got all of this data here. How do we take, 100 questions and crunch it down into a smaller number of factors that are still explaining the majority of the information? So when we did this for this particular example, we came up with the five themes on the right here. And I'll just explain a couple of those quickly. So call reluctance, for example, basically includes things like the salesperson's reluctant to capitalise on existing relationships. They lose energy on the phone. They're reluctant to follow up on leads and so on. So there's a whole bunch of questions which go into that component that are all similar and give us a score for that customer in terms of their call reluctance. Circle of influence is another interesting one. Probably the best way to describe it is, if you think about your circle of influence, how do you define that? And I was reading recently one way to do that, a test that's applied, is if you took 250 names from the phone book and you gave that to, say, a bunch of people, maybe it's colleagues or whatever, and you said, can you write down next to every name how many people you know with that last name? And by know that person, it's if you were on a bus and you're sitting next to each other, you'd actually both know each other's first name. So you'd be actually able to say hello. It's not I know the CEO and, he doesn't know you. So you've actually got to be a mutual acquaintance. A very good measure of an effective salesperson. Okay, so what do we do with these factors? Once we've got all these factors, the salespeople have done this test at recruitment. We've got all these factors. We can include them in our modelling to work out which of them seem to drive better sales. So what did we see? We saw that call reluctance was a significant factor. So on the right of the chart here, we've actually got people with higher call reluctance. So they're more reluctant to pick up the phone, follow up on leads and so on. And this is a pure effect, okay? So what's a pure effect? It's the effect in the model after controlling for all other factors, after controlling for their tenure, after controlling for the market share, everything else. This is the effect on sales. For people who are more call reluctant, they're actually making less sales. Basically, relative performance, that's just relative sales performance. So once we understand these are the types of customers that are actually better performers, we can use that in recruitment. We can actually say, here's a factor, I'll actually rank people by call reluctance, and I'm more likely to employ people who have a low reluctance. The next thing we need to understand is, what's the actual impact of a salesperson? Okay? And the best way to look at this is by tenure. So naturally, over time, salespeople get better in their role, and they basically have an increase in performance and at some point a flattening. So starting on the left, just to explain the chart in a bit of detail, we've got none. So none is, if we take a particular location, there is no salesperson in that location. So there may be sales being generated because they're actually being generated through other channels or other salespeople in surrounding locations. If we've got no salesperson, there's a benchmark. for sales performance. If we add a person at 10 year zero, so they're in there for, you know, their first day on the job, they're not actually making any difference. They're not generating any additional sales. It actually took 6 months until these salespeople were actually generating an impact. And then after 6 months, it was a rapid increase. And that increase started to diminish slowly and slowly as a salesperson reaches the, you know, ability of their role, the capacity of the area and so on, until up to 36 months. And then it's fairly flat from then on. Another question, another question that we needed to answer, and it's really introducing sort of this other concept of what's the impact of putting another salesperson into an area where I've already got salespeople. So take an area of Sydney, let's say St George. If I've got three salespeople there and I add one more salesperson to the area, what's the impact? Well, I'm going to generate new sales from that additional person, but they're also going to take sales that I would have already made from the other salespeople. So there's actually this effect of internal competition. And we need to allow for that properly to make sure that we don't overestimate the impact of a salesperson. So to explain this chart, you need to start on the left. If we've got an area that there's no salespeople, so there's still sales being generated, basically there's no salesperson there. As soon as we add one salesperson to the area, there is no internal competition because they're just competing with themselves. So that salesperson will move up the 10-year curve and have an impact on the sales in that region. As we add the second person, both those people are generating additional sales because they're having an impact, but there's an offset because we've got two people and they're actually taking a little bit away from each other. And it diminishes. And at some point you can work out, well, what is that saturation point? Is it three salespeople is the maximum, four, and so on? The other concept to look at is what's the impact of the market share? So my existing brand presence, how does that have an impact? Is it strong? If I've got a market share, do I have better growth? At some point, does it diminish? And in this particular example, we found that basically for low market shares, you had low growth. Okay, and that's because you don't have a foothold. You don't have any brand presence. But as your market share grows, that's where you actually do have a foothold in the market and you've got much better performance. But it starts to tip out. And at that point, it will be different for every industry, but for this company, it was at about 35%. The performance started to turn back down. And that's because there were other competitors in the industry who each had their share, and at some point, you're getting to a share where you can't actually steal those customers from those competitors. They might be actually embedded with those competitors. They're long-term customers. In theory, it could be 100%. You might be able to grow your market share in one particular area to 100%. But for a lot of industries where there are other big players, you might actually flatten out at, you know, a third or 50% market share. So once we've done all this modelling, the question is, how do we pull it all together? How do we pull it together in terms of an optimal distribution strategy? And by optimal distribution strategy, we mean how many sales staff do I need and the location of those sales staff. Now, I mentioned that we talked about sales staff a lot here, but really it applies exactly the same for branches or store locations or brokers or anything else that we wanted to do this sort of analysis for. Okay, so what we can start with is what's our current allocation? Where are our salespeople currently located? So this is Metro Sydney. Each dot represents an individual salesperson, if it's not too small to see. And each of these salespeople have different characteristics, a different tenure, and they're in a location with different characteristics, different market share, and so on. So we can generate the expected performance for each of those salespeople. So we might have a potential strategy is a naive reduction. So say we need to reduce salespeople. We need to get rid of 10%. One approach might be, okay, we've looked at some rules of thumb, we've looked at some benchmark statistics, we've worked out that southwestern Sydney is actually underperforming. It's severely underperforming. Okay, let's reduce all those sales staff, just take them away. The impact could be huge. It might be that southwestern Sydney is underperforming because it's a staff churn problem there. And actually everyone's at low tenure, therefore they're not hitting peak performance yet. The optimal allocation approach essentially looks at every individual sales staff, takes them out as if they are not there anymore, and works out the resulting loss in profit, the resulting bottom line loss, and then puts them back in. Takes everyone out one at a time. And in the first step, you say, okay, which salesperson, if I take out, results in the least loss, okay? And then I'll take out the next person with the least amount of loss, and so on. And in some cases, in this case actually, there was an increase in bottom line by reducing sales staff by, say, 20. So if we took out 20 people, because their costs were higher than the sales that they're actually generating, actually get an increase in profit. And you know, the easy way to explain that is they might be in areas that are poor areas, there's no opportunity for further growth, or they could actually be over-allocated. They're in an area that's saturated, it's got too many salespeople, and by reducing them, we'll reduce that internal competition effect. So the next step is think of every area and test a new salesperson in that area, or a reallocation of the current salespeople. So if I take each area and I put a new salesperson in there, what's the resulting impact on my bottom line? And add the first person to the location where they have the biggest impact, second person to the next location, and so on. So this would be the result of adding an additional 30 salespeople. Likewise, we can add, you know, additional 100. So you can see it's going to be, you know, in this case it was first 30 were going more to the north side of Sydney, and then from then on it was actually more South Sydney. So the benefit is that each allocation, as I mentioned, is to the area that will impact the bottom line the most. And what does this mean? It means that we're actually able to produce a trade-off between number of sales staff and additional value generated. So starting on the left, we've got our current situation. So current situation, if we work out what the benchmark performance is, and the two approaches are the same. If we move to the right, the release is actually, if we did a naive release, say we took away 10% of salespeople, we'd get a 10% reduction in performance. Alternatively, with our distribution model, if we take away 10% of salespeople, because the cost savings outweigh the reduction in revenue and profit, we actually get an increase in performance. The next step is a reallocation of those resources. So in the naive approach, if we reallocate them, we get back to the same performance. With the distribution model, we reallocate them to the best area, we're going to get the biggest hit from allocating to those areas. And when we add 50, we get another hit. And when we add 100, we get another increase. And at some point, the costs outweigh the additional benefit, and we're allocating people to areas that are already saturated or they've just got low opportunities for growth, so we actually hit our maximum profit. Well, I've wrapped it up pretty quick. I think there's lots of time for questions, but I think that gives a good overview of an interesting case example. I think it's an exciting case example. In terms of final thoughts, basically there isn't a lot of science being applied to distribution strategy. And this means that decisions can take a lot longer because nobody knows what's the impact. Nobody can quantify, if I do this, what's the actual impact? And it's harder to justify decisions. With this sort of approach, we can test different scenarios and say which one actually ranks better than the other. Distribution is key for many products, and it's also a very large expense. So it's important to be able to actually make sensible decisions here. And in terms of a cost per acquisition, the distribution channel will be a massive component of the cost per acquisition. And being able to actually minimise that will be very important for future success. And finally, I mean, actuarial techniques really do bring a lot to this area in terms of basically data analysis, modelling, and optimisation. Okay, thank you.
Do you want to stay up there, Mitch, because I don't think we've got a microphone here. If there's okay. Questions from the floor.
Yes.
Michael O'Neill from Investors Mutual. I've just got a question on broader application. So obviously you've looked at productivity of sales staff by local area. Have you also, I mean, is there appetite for applying this to look at productivity of customers and targeting on customer demographics? Just one other question, if I could, which is going back to your principal components analysis, could you give us a bit of a feel for the relative contribution of each of those variables in explaining the variance?
Yep, sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's good. In terms of customer analysis, I mean, customer analysis, I would put that into the pricing aspect. So if you can price for individual customers and you know their profitability, you know how sticky they are. So we had our framework, and one of our elements was expected customer cash flows, which included churn and basically the value of the customer. That's where you would try and model customers as much as possible. And once you've done that, if you can vary by price, if you can have offers for those customers, targeting and so on, segment them, then that's how you try and attract the right customers. So I think that really does live in the price realm, and we've done a lot of work in that area, but you know, it's a different discussion for today. From today, your second question was around what one again? The yes. Yep. They didn't all come out as significant. There were two that came out of the five. In terms of overall contribution of those two, I'd say that obviously tenure is the most important. So customer tenure basically describes whether you've got a customer in that location or not. So that was key. Actually, the type of customer is probably, you know, it's probably more like half or a quarter of the importance of tenure, but still significant nonetheless, and I guess a key insight for this sort of analysis. One of the ones that actually wasn't presented here just because of the layout was rule followers. So there's actually a rule around rule... There's a theme or a component around rule followers for salespeople. And it actually turned out that people who followed the rules were better. Now, you might think it's the opposite. For a salesperson, they've got to be quite energetic and different and basically getting out there and doing stuff. But they needed to be able to follow the rules. Otherwise, they were just cowboys, I guess. So that was another interesting insight, and I think that's the sort of thing where you've shown something that's counterintuitive to what management might already think, and that's where you're making a big difference to the way they do their processes and recruit.
Thank you, Ian Pereira. I was just wondering, have you done any work on how remuneration models for the salespeople affect the results? Because I think that's quite an interesting area.
Yeah, that's good. We haven't done it on the exact remuneration models. One of the components included for one of the companies was the previous performance results. So they would actually get a ranking in terms of their sales performance. And that was obviously a key factor. If you were a good performer in the past, then you continue to be a good performer. You're just a cut above the rest. But in terms of, and that would relate to bonuses, so they're getting better bonuses and therefore they're performing better going forward. But we haven't done anything on their specific remuneration targets or structures, essentially. It's amazing looking at this sales data. I find it fascinating. The fact that, you know, I guess as actuaries, we're usually insulated from this sort of stuff. But with one particular client, there are salespeople who outperform others by like three times. And it's just amazing that they can be that good at what they do. It's not the area, it's the person. And there are other people who are in areas that could be really poor, and there's all the excuses in the world, but at the end of the day, they are just poor salespersons. So what this actually gives, and it's something that I didn't actually talk about, is a very good independent benchmark of what that salesperson should be performing at in their area. So you can no longer say, oh, I'm not performing well because I'm in a poor area. It's actually, well, you're allowed for your area, so you're still performing poorer than that. Or alternatively, I'm performing really good. But if it's a good area, the benchmark will be increased for you. So you've actually got to overperform to that benchmark.
Bruce Vincent. I was reading the paper and just listening to, I was thinking about the topic in relation to financial services. And one of the things that struck me is actual choice of distribution channel is actually quite relevant to that, and you know, which channels do you use, how much do you weight each channel, what channel conflict you've got, and then that got me to the distributors themselves. They're not necessarily salaried sales force. They range from salaried right through to perhaps totally independent. And so there's another dimension about the people. I think it links up with Ian's point about remuneration, but it made me think of a fifth P for financial services, which is persistency. Now, I guess it's not unique to financial services, but it's actually a critical thing I think when we're thinking about the power of the distributors, that they're not just salaried people sitting there. They're actually really a very important intermediary between the company and the ultimate customer. So this is sort of a bit of a question, a statement rather than a question. But I'm just trying to think, how do we actually, what can we do to use this base analysis and perhaps extend it? And maybe others will have some other thoughts on that as well.
Yep. I mean, I think the power is being able to actually understand those distributors in more detail as well. Think about a particular broker or advisor as one entity. But in reality, there's a number of advisors under that entity. And if we can track those individual advisors and understand where they're moving, some of them might actually move across between two brokers. And in that case, do the customers follow with them? Do they actually cause internal churn? And if we can track all that information, then this approach is 100% applicable. We can still estimate at the unique level for each individual salesperson. And like you said, you've got your internal sales advisors as well. They're all one entity, a sales-generating entity as well. So I think with the appropriate data, it's absolutely applicable.
Hello, this is John King from Deloitte. I think it's a very interesting concept. I'm just not entirely sold that you're able to calibrate your model to the real world, and it comes back to because you said some salespeople are really good, and how do you know that you're actually quantifying this or this not contaminating your data when you're trying to contaminate, let's say, if you're trying to quantify how valuable an area is, maybe you just have some really good people in there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is there? I mean, how can you overcome that in your model?
I think we just need to have. The key is multivariate modeling is to have as many drivers in there as possible and as clean a data as possible. So the extent to which we can pick up, is this an area that's growing fast, or is it an area where it's actually the salespeople who are generating the sales? The actual longevity of the salespeople can work against you. If they've been in there for a long time and you can't actually separate it, then it does make it difficult. If we've got actual movements between areas, then you're actually testing different salespeople in different areas over time. It's much richer. It's like the old, if I'm trying to measure the effectiveness of my TV spend on generating sales, if I've always spent $1 million a month, then I don't know what's the impact. But if I've spent varying levels of TV, then I actually get a richness of information from that. When I spent less, I got less sales, and I actually can build up the information from that. So it does come down to the variety. It comes down to the richness in the data, and if you don't have that, it is going to be more difficult.
Philip Everett, I've just got one question. It's about the data that you do get. Do you get data from multiple industries? Because obviously salespeople are very good at explaining away why they're not doing well, and they're ranking themselves relative to the other salespeople in their organisation, but the whole organisation could be, you know, poor performer. Do you try and do those overlays?
In terms of the whole industry, this is really calibrated. This is meant to come up with a ranking between salespeople. So at a total level, whether it produces the exact right result for the business, it may not, because it's a micro model. It's building up from the bottom. So it's going to project off whatever the past was. If growth in the past has been 40%, it's going to project 40% going forward. If the industry's turning, then you need to allow for that. So basically, we just calibrate the model at a total level to what the budget forecasts are. And then you can say, actually, if this is my budget forecast, how's that broken down between the salespeople? So it's still a ground-up approach. It's more of an allocation approach.
Okay. The reason I ask that is that if you're an underperformer, poaching somebody else's better salespeople's always one of the better ways to go.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the findings, particularly for this company, the fact that they realised, actually, when I put a new salesperson in, it's 6 months before they do anything. It's 12 months before they've delivered a decent amount of value. And it's not until 24 months or 36 months that they're hitting their peak. So why actually recruit brand new people? Go out there and poach from the other companies, and you're going to hit those targets much quicker.
Thanks.
James Atkinson, if distribution approach was just to get rid of the marginally the worst performers and to put new people in areas where there's the best average performance, I guess it would have the effect of getting rid of either poor performers or people in areas that aren't there. There's no requirement or there's not the market there, or also getting rid of people where there's it's a good area but there's just too many sales force. How would this approach add more value than just a sort of dynamic getting rid of your marginally low performers and putting people where the best performers are?
Yeah. No, the key is if we've got an area that's currently poor performing, I guess a simple example that I had up there was the naive kind of reduction. So you take everyone in out of southwestern Sydney and you reduce and you take them away because the performance is bad. Now, it might be the opportunity in that area is quite big, but all the people are low on their tenure. So they're not in the role, they're not actually producing sales yet. With this model, we can actually project forward. So I didn't mention, but we won't just project what's their sales in the next 12 months or the next 6 months. It's their sales in, say, 2 years' time or 3 years' time. And by that time, if those salespeople actually stay in that area, their sales will actually increase to a level that will be much higher than what it is today. So in that case, we're actually not saying this area is poor. It's actually got huge opportunity, so don't unallocate from that area. In the case where you've got an area that's oversaturated, you'll only reduce people until you reach the right level of salespeople in that area. So every time you take a salesperson out, you need to recalculate what's the value generated by the other salespeople, and it will increase because the saturation has gone down. So I think it's in essence, it's all in the way that optimization is done and thinking about, I guess, going forward in the future in terms of not just what's the benchmark performance today, but what it will be in 2 years.
While everybody else is waiting, I've got a little quick question for you. Sure. You did talk about customer optimization. Was there anything you did in your work? I didn't quite hear it around. You know, it's one thing to have linking the type of salesman to the type of sale they achieve and therefore the value of the customer rather than just dollars, so you can go one step further. Have you done anything in that space, or is that starting to all get a bit tricky?
Not specifically in this example. We didn't link the type of sale. It's a pretty homogenous product. I guess you could look at actually which salespeople are performing better in different types of products, and that could be either actually doing them all individually or trying to allow for the product in the performance as well. So, not yet.
Do you consider any other factors like height, eye colour? and
no.
All the factors that actually do drive a lot of those
Yeah.
outcomes.
Well, a few of the ones that we didn't show were the age and gender versions. In this case, women were actually much better salespeople, and it tended to be the younger salespeople as well that were much better. So, I don't know. You don't want to be ageist or sexist, so I didn't put it up here. But, you know, typically I guess you can make an argument for everything. Maybe it's the younger people who have got more motivation, they're more out there, they're mixing better, whatever it happens to be. There's also another interesting finding in this one. We had salespeople who had actually had a long tenure with the organisation, but they were in the role for a short period. And they actually tended to be poor performers. It might be that they've landed in the role, but they've lost, you know, they've basically been with the organisation for a long time. They're not as motivated, they're not as fresh, and they've landed in the role for whatever reason, and they tended to be poor performers as well. So, a lot of interesting stuff there.
I can explain that to you if you like.
Been there, done that?
Well, it gets back to selling. You sell on benefits, not on features, and people who are very familiar with a product will tell you all about the features, but forget to tell you about the benefits.
Yeah.
Ignorance sometimes is bliss. You stick to the story, you follow the rules, and if the sale goes cold, you walk off. The other person keeps at it, believing what they've got. Sorry. Go.
Yep.
Yeah. Sorry. Just John King. And I'm just curious about the size of the model that you've based. This is a specific case study. I mean, how much data did you have, or how much is there a minimum amount of data that you would need before you can actually start drawing conclusions from the output? And how much it's just randomness?
Yeah, fair enough. In this case, you want multiple periods of data. So at a minimum a couple of years. In this case, we had 2 years' worth of data. It was a relatively new portfolio, if you like. So more years is better. And the size of the sales force, at least, you know, you need enough richness in there to be able to test different types of, you know, customers, essentially, or different types of salespeople. So in this case, at least a couple of hundred salespeople produces interesting results. And that could be not actually 200 enforced at a particular time. It could be, you know, 150 for a year, and then, you know, they're continually changing. So every time a salesperson is changing, you get new richness of information from them. And essentially, I guess, yeah, the rest of it is geographically wherever it's located. If it's a national model, then that's better. And I guess enough sales volume to be able to model it reliably. So, yeah, hope that helps.
Have you incorporated external market factors into how that changes distribution behaviour over time? So, for example, one of the things we saw going through the financial crisis in some markets was pre-financial crisis, you had a particular sort of behaviour when the markets were good. Core reluctance in a particular channel could actually be quite low. Let's say they were selling investment products. You have the financial crisis hit. Suddenly they don't want to get on the phone because someone's going to say to them, why has my benefit gone down 50%? Those sort of external factors can actually dramatically impact how your distribution channel operates and how you manage through it. Given you've got that sort of information from the last couple of years with financial crisis, have you done anything to sort of look at how that changes things and how that works into the model?
There's two ways we approach it. In the distribution modelling approach, we haven't actually incorporated any of those at this stage. It's the same sort of thing, econometric modelling for basically media spend. Okay, and in that case, we try and incorporate as much known information about the past as possible. So if we know there's a particular event on a day, we'll include that as a factor in our model, and we'll test that specifically. But after the second approach is, so we'll know, is there a significant impact from that event? After that's occurred, we will actually look at how well is our model tracking against time? Did we predict well at each point in time? And if there's an unexplained event, then we'll dig into that in more detail and try and say, actually, what is this? You know, is there something causing it? And identify it that way. Once, I think, the form approach is better because you're coming with a hypothesis. You're actually trying to answer a specific question. And when you know that question, you can actually test it against different areas, different types of salespeople, whatever it happens to be, different channels. So it might be that there was an event on this day. You can actually, you know, fit a I guess, statistical interaction is the modelling term, but you could test what impact did that have on channel A, channel B, C, and so on. So I think it's about identifying it, knowing which ones are there, and then incorporating it into the models.
David Lee from the Boston Consulting Group. Just a quick question. What was the client's position or the allocation strategy prior to calling you guys in, and how were they allocating their salespeople then? And what's happened since you guys have been in, and, you know, have you heard back from, you know, with regards to results implementation? What's happened then since?
Yeah, great question. Before we joined, I mean, they were a bit baffled, really. They were trying to argue for quite an increase in the sales force and having trouble getting that approved. And that's essentially the catalyst for the work. How can I justify a big increase in performance? They'd had a lot of growth, and it was about saying, okay, that growth is actually going to continue. It's not going to peter out. So when we came in, they were using things like rules of thumb. They're basically just trying to say, okay, I'm low in this area, I'm high in this area, mapping things and so on. We've seen other clients applying an other companies applying an average salesperson value, so trying to do it that way. So I guess something we haven't showed here, but for this particular example, when we actually finished all the modelling and we did the optimization, there's a really important component after that, which is actually making it practical. Because here we've got an analytical optimization which says you should put someone in this area. Now, in practice, it might be an area where you can't attract any talent. Okay, you just can't get salespeople. Or when we do, say, the reallocation, we release people and we reallocate them. You can't physically move people from state to state. They live in an area, that's where they work. So you've got to be practical. And what we did was construct a a tool for them which allowed us to test different scenarios with all the sales managers. So we had all the sales managers from around the country, actually sat down one at a time with all their areas and said, if you actually took that person out and moved them to the area next door, what's the impact? And then they'd say, actually, I'm thinking about putting someone into Rockhampton. Okay, what's the impact of putting one person there? So we actually worked with them to come up with that strategy, and we delivered that tool to them, and I guess the outcome was they still used it. They still are using it. They come back for recalibrations every now and then, and they're still using it on a periodic basis to basically make those decisions, come up with the benchmark. So definitely needs that practical element and sitting down with the actual salespeople. And I guess the information there was great, being able to actually sit with people and understand, oh, okay, they might say, that person's underperforming, oh, but I know that person and they're not doing great in the job. So they can actually overlay elements of the area, the challenges that the salesperson has in that area, and the type of salesperson that you just don't get from the data.
Any more questions? We've only got a few minutes anyway before lunch, so...
Okay.
Wrapped
up?
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you very much. If you have any more questions, just feel free to contact me. Cheers.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mitch. I think there's a... This strikes me as being like a tip of a little iceberg, that there's a lot of work that we could, as a profession, we can probably add in this space. In particular, adding the analytic outcomes and the objective outcomes you get from this sort of modelling in with some of the, you know, psychological and behavioural outcomes, you know, as, you know, around selling techniques and all the rest of it, what drives good behaviour. You can actually see that this actually reinforces some of those developments that I've seen, as I said, around, you know, what makes good selling. So that's great. But anyway, would everyone please join with me in thanking Mitch for a fantastic and interesting presentation.